Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. If you're grateful for consumer protection laws in this country, that you can drive a car that doesn't explode when hit from behind, that employers have to meet on-the-job safety standards, or that the Environmental Protection Agency exists, you can thank longtime consumer advocate Ralph Nader.
In 1965, Nader released his book, Unsafe at Any Speed, which put a spotlight on the American auto industry's disregard of safety and eventually forced it to install seatbelts in its cars and make safety a priority. Ever since, he has decried and challenged the growing power of corporate America, which has been a major theme in his five presidential campaigns. Now he has a new book, which calls for an alliance between left and right in pursuit of a democracy where corporate interests hold far less sway.
Nader says libertarians from the right and progressives from the left can unite to cut off government support from corporations, end American adventures abroad, make taxes more fair, rein in the Patriot Act, and establish honest government. And he goes even further. Impeach President Obama? He's okay with that. Legalize drugs? Absolutely. Ally with Rand Paul? Well, yes, if that's what it takes. His new book is called Unstoppable, the Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. And Ralph Nader joins us now from NPR in Washington. And Ralph Nader, welcome to Radio Boston. It's very good to have you.
Thank you, Anthony Brooks.
Yeah, and let me invite our listeners to join the conversation. Can an alliance between the left and the libertarian right make progress on issues that matter to you? Healthcare, climate change, civil liberties. What's your question for Ralph Nader? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. So, Ralph Nader, in your book, you talk about 25 potential reforms that can be accomplished through a left-right alliance. So let's talk about at least a few of them in the time that we have, where folks from the left and the right can create common cause. For example, civil liberties. How does that work?
That's a huge alliance of left-right from authentic conservatives, libertarians, progressives, and liberals. They don't like the restrictions, the arbitrary nature, the secrecy of implementing the Patriot Act. For example, rummaging through your library records, and if the librarian tells you that they received a national security letter, they can be accused of a crime by the federal government, or searching your home and not telling you for 72 hours, going through your medical and financial records without adequate probable cause. That's a big one. And the problem is that the Congress has not gotten a message yet. So every time the Patriot Act comes up every few years for renewal, there isn't even a debate. So what I want to do in this book is put an operational cutting edge to this massive alliance shown in the public opinion polls and others, that people do not want to trade so much liberty for so-called security.
Hmm. Another one of your ideas where liberals and libertarians would unite is around a push to end what you call unconstitutional wars. That's an issue where they can come together, right?
That's right. Madison and Jefferson, they thought the greatest achievement of the Constitution was making sure that the president could not plunge the nation into war. They put that authority exclusively in the Congress. And what we've seen increasingly under Clinton, more under Bush, same under Obama, that any kind of attack, bombing, drones, invasions, incursions into all kinds of countries in the third world, based on suspicion or whatever, occurring without congressional declaration of war or even congressional, in many cases, appropriation of funds, such as the attack on Libya, which has now turned Libya into a chaotic internal civil war, spilling over into Mali and Central Africa, as we've read in the news reports. I think there's a huge support for people saying that you have to obey the Constitution when you take the oath of office for the presidency.
Hmm. Another issue, fair taxation and opposition to what you call government support for corporations and getting tough on corporate crime. Here's another area of potential alliance between liberals and libertarians.
Yeah, the right call it crony capitalism, where the big corporations, especially the big banks, for example, and drug companies, insurance companies, muscle their way into Washington and use our government power to feather their nests with subsidies, handouts, giveaways, bailouts constantly, day after day. That's a huge left-right alliance. They don't like that. That's not supposed to be capitalism, sink or swim, based on your own merits or demerits. The second area is they want law and order, not just on streets. They want law and order on the corporate suites. They want to put the prosecutorial effort on the crooks in Wall Street. Now, only one has been prosecuted and sent to jail, a rather minor executive, for crashing the entire economy, unemploying 8 million workers, shredding pensions and mutual funds, and then going to Washington for a huge taxpayer bailout in 2008-2009. And I think it comes in over 80%. They want to break up these banks that are too big to fail or too big to jail.
Yeah. Now, as I said, you've got 25 proposed redirections and reforms that this alliance could address. We're not going to go through all of them. I'm going to ask you about one more, though, and then I want to talk to you about how this alliance might or might not work. But yes, you also talk about health, a reform of health care. And I'm really interested in this because my question is, where's the common ground between left and right on this issue?
Well, the common ground is between left and right who like Medicare. Elderly people like Medicare. Some are liberals, some are conservatives. They see that it works, even though it's been undermined and defrauded more than many of us would like by the corporate commercial interests, overbilling and phantom operations and all the rest. So this proposal, which I think since Harry Truman has been supported by a majority of the American people, is full Medicare for all, everybody in, nobody out, and this is really important, free choice of doctor and hospital. None of these narrowing, restrictive networks where someone in the panhandle of West Virginia pays $14,000 out of these health exchanges for a family of four, and then is told they can't go to Johns Hopkins or they can't go to Charlotte, in West Virginia. They have to stay in that panhandle area.
So Medicaid for their health care. So this is the public option, essentially.
Well, there isn't. No, unfortunately, Mr. Obama stepped away from the public option.
No, I understand that, but I mean, is that what Medicaid for All essentially would be? It would be
simpler. It would be just like in Canada, where they present a Medicare card, they hardly ever see a bill, and they're taken care of from cradle to grave in terms of their health care, and they do it on half the per capita cost, about $4,400 a year per capita. We're up over $9,000 expenditure per capita in this country, and there are tens of millions still uninsured.
Mm. But I'm curious, how would you forge a political alliance to back something like that when the debate in this country has been around the Affordable Care Act, which is arguably a market-based reform approach pushed by centrist Democrats, opposed by Republicans only because it had Obama's name attached to it, it seems to me. So where's the common cause? I mean, you know, who's going to rally for expanded Medicaid for all?
Well, it has to come from the people. I mean, the opinion alliance, the agreement on so many of these left-right issues is already out there. It has to be brought operationally. It has to get the attention of the media. It has to be picked up by some candidates, local, state, national, and it has to be put on the table of the incumbents from the state legislature to the Congress. That's what this book grapples with. It does not sugarcoat this at all. It shows how the powers that be throughout history have used divide and rule. They want to divide and rule left and right, focus them on the areas they do disagree on, like school prayer, reproductive rights, gun control, etc., so that they don't turn around and focus on where they agree. Because once left-right get together, it's unstoppable. I've seen it in the past. We've worked it on legislation like the False Claims Act of 1986, challenging corporate fraud, the Whistleblower Act last year, giving federal employees protection for blowing the whistle on corporate fraud on the taxpayer, the stopping the Clinch River Breeder Reactor in 1983. All of these defeated the corporate lobbyists. And it was because that the members of Congress, with their finger to the wind, saw that what was coming in those days by mail and telephone and telegram, but now by email. It comes in left-right. They are terrified. The corporatists and their political allies in Washington are terrified by a left-right alliance because that spells a major majority that's unstoppable.
Mm. And the Unstoppable is the name of Ralph Nader's book. It's called Unstoppable, The Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. Listeners, you can join the conversation with Ralph Nader. Do you like what you hear? Does it make sense, this alliance between liberals on the left, libertarians somewhere in the middle right? Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Let me ask you about how this would work. I mean, you have such a long and distinguished history of consumer rights advocacy, pushing for government safety regulations, and I'm wondering if this kind of alliance you're talking about now, would you have to forget about anything that involves new government regulations, higher taxes, more spending? Wouldn't that mean giving up on big liberal priorities like expanding anti-poverty programs, guaranteeing universal preschool, or big investments in infrastructure, for example?
You basically say left-right people back home say to themselves, we disagree on ABC issues, and we're not going to agree anytime soon. But we happen to agree on WXYZ issues. We happen to agree that both conservative and liberal workers are having their jobs displaced by multinational corporations taking advantage of NAFTA and the World Trade Organization that they helped lobby through, and shipping our jobs and industries to often fascist and communist regimes overseas who know how to keep their workers in their place at 80 cents an hour and then ship the products back to the U.S. You see, that's an area of convergence between left-right. So I understand, Anthony, there are areas that they very strongly disagree in,
right,
especially in the education. But we have to recognize the following. If we want to get something done in this country, we can't simply focus on where we disagree. We've got to focus on where we agree. And as this book points out, where left-right agrees are on very momentous issues. They're fundamental democracy issues. They're fundamental economic issues. Like they disagree, let's say, on the tax rate for individuals. But they agree that Wall Street should be subjected to a speculation tax.
Mm-hmm.
They agree with Ronald Reagan, who thought that all income should be taxed at the same level. In other words, you don't have 15% tax on capital gains and dividends and maybe 25-30% tax on worker income. So you see, what this book does, it shines the spotlight on the areas of agreement, goes into the history of them, doesn't sugarcoat it, confronts the obstacles, and it says, folks, it's up to you to do what those farmers did in 1774 when, before the fighting started against King George, they formed committees of correspondence in Worcester and Springfield. And I know Boston got most of the credit to start the revolution, but the real groundwork in turning out thousands of farmers to take away the appointments to their town council and their sheriffs and their courts, it started there, and it was a marvelous example of consensus. I'm sure these farmers disagreed on a lot of other things, but they agreed on self-determination, self-government, and they didn't want the equivalent of these giant East India corporations and the British Crown twisting and distorting their economic opportunity.
All right, Ralph Nader, stand by, because I want to get some listeners into the conversation. Listeners, you heard it right there. There's the challenge from Ralph Nader. It's up to you. So let's bring in some of these descendants, I guess, of some of those revolutionary farmers, maybe.
Yeah.
Ryan is calling from Cambridge. Ryan, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. Mr. Nader, I agree wholeheartedly that we do need to form some form of left-right alliance. I wonder if you could speak to the degree to which the unfortunate reality that far too often those on the right, those who call themselves libertarians, who may or may not be what you may refer to as a true conservative, and their willingness to leverage things like racism, homophobia, xenophobia, etc., in order to continue to drive that wedge. How do we effectively build that coalition if we can't get those who might be allied around key issues to really focus on the true issues at hand versus the distractions that are so often put forth?
Well, when they start working on areas of convergence, left-right, they get to know each other. They see they don't have horns. And believe it or not, when you get down off the abstraction ladder of generalities, political ideologies, and you go where people back home work, raise their families, vote, and meet each other, it becomes very empirical. They react. whether they're liberals or conservatives. When Ron Paul, a libertarian, teamed up with Congressman Barney Frank, a liberal Democrat, in 2010, and actually staffed a caucus to take on the bloated military budget. Well, I mean, there you are right there. You couldn't get two more polar, but they worked together, and they started learning about each other. They're not going to agree on everything, obviously, but when people work together on areas right from the get-go where they agree, it becomes a completely different pattern. People get a morale boost. They feel that they really can influence these politicians and these big corporatists. They feel that maybe they can put some muscle in the preamble to our Constitution, we the people, which hasn't yet been transformed into we the corporation. It's a lot of this is Main Street versus Wall Street as well. It's tremendous resentment about the priorities and privileges and immunities of these Wall Street banks and other financial institutions, and how even when they're caught once in a while by the Justice Department, as the Swiss bank was just caught, it was an utterly sweetheart deal, and the CEO for the last 6 years kept his job.
Ryan, thanks so much for that call. Ralph Nader, let's go to Joe. He's calling from Melbourne, Florida. He's listening on an app. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? First of all, I want to say, Mr. Nader, the country owes you such a debt. Outside of your running for president, I've always admired you. I learned a lot growing up, and you've really been the behind my initiative to always speak up to power. I want to say I'm not a philosophy major, but when I listen to you speak, very similar. I've told people for years: read Machiavelli, read The Prince, and read how two opposing powers keep everybody at each other's throats, and the third party just gets away with murder. And I think that's what's happened in this country for years. I hope people read your book. I hope there are people in both parties that will consider, you know, what you present. And I thank you for your service to this country.
Joe, thanks so much for the call.
Very well put.
Ralph, I'd like you to respond to that, though. I mean, does Machiavelli's The Prince have lessons there that in what you're trying to talk to us about?
Oh, yeah, magnificent. I'm glad he referred to it. It was the classic divide and rule that Machiavelli analyzed even back then. It was almost like human nature by the few to overpower the many. It's divide and rule. We see it here. We see it in other countries. I was just in Senator Markey's office, and I want him to sponsor an event on Capitol Hill where he connects with a right-wing senator and says, okay, we disagree on XYZ, but we agree on these issues. Let's have a gathering with the press and get the ball rolling so we break this gridlock in Congress. By the way, you know, the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform, before it was eviscerated by 5 out of 9 members of the Supreme Court, it was a classic left-right. Russ Feingold, liberal Democrat, John McCain, conservative Republican, overpowered a lot of corporate lobbyists who want to continue buying and renting our Congress and our political system.
You know, I take to heart your concern about the control of corporate forces in this country and how it affects the political system here or infects the political system. But I'm wondering if there's something else going on here that your prescription might not address, and that is this inability, this gridlock that we're seeing in Washington and this inability of people to come together, because there have been lots of examples down through history of Republicans and Democrats, of liberals and conservatives working together, but that's just not happening anymore or nearly as much. Why is that?
Well, one is that both parties are dialing for the same dollars, the commercial dollars. Obama raised a lot of money from Wall Street, more than any other presidential candidate. But both parties want to control the Congress. So they're in a natural conflict situation. They're being funded by commercial interests. But McConnell wants to be the majority leader of the Senate over Harry Reid, and Pelosi wants to replace John Boehner, and the heck with the rest of the country. There's a real careerism operating here, and when you have that kind of careerism, you tend to concentrate on the areas that really do divide the Republican-Democrat rather than on the areas that could reflect the public opinion left-right of the people back home. I've seen it again and again, and it's very, very unappetizing to see people who work for us not represent fundamental interests even in the area of care for children, for heaven's sake. They're bickering on that. They say, well, we don't have money to repair America, public works, infrastructure, real good jobs that can't be exported to China. Yeah, but they have hundreds of billions of unaudited dollars in the Pentagon budget to blow up countries and bridges and highways around the world. They have hundreds of billions of dollars to provide corporate welfare or crony capitalism subsidies, handouts, and giveaways. So this book is attempting really to do what no book has tried to do, is shine the spotlight on these areas of agreement and show what the obstacles are for going from the existing public opinion that's already out there into an operational mode to catch the attention of the media and then get on the table of the political structure between elections and during elections. Once it gets on the table, it's off to the races. It's unstoppable.
Unstoppable. Well, let me ask you, who might lead such an alliance? You've said that it might be someone like Kentucky Senator Rand Paul. What makes him a credible leader of this new right-left coalition?
Well, on certain issues. Like, guess what? He doesn't like secret law, like secret memos justifying attacking Americans overseas with drones. I mean, can you imagine a country devoted to the rule of law that has secret law, secret courts, secret judges, secret memos, secret operations that should be exposed to congressional approval, like military adventures abroad? So I like that. He's willing to spend 12 hours on the Senate floor making it a big issue. I like that. I don't agree with him at all on his averse opposition to health and safety regulation or to full Medicare for all. But I take him for what he is. That's what's so important. We've got to do that everywhere at the local, state, and national level. You'll see this country turn around a lot faster than anybody, skeptical or cynical, ever dreamed could happen. You know, here's where I'd really like it to come out. Before the Iraq War, in the 9 months before Bush and Cheney went and invaded a criminal, unconstitutional invasion of Iraq, there were over 300 retired generals, admirals, national security officials, prime diplomats who opposed the war. This was unprecedented. They did it in op-eds. They did it on radio programs. They did it in letters to the editor. And a lot of them were Republicans. A lot of them were Democrats. Now, there was a left-right, if it got any support, say, from some wealthy person who also wanted to oppose the war in Iraq and the disasters that have happened since, if they got media support and an infrastructure and they could go up on the Hill and make Congress adhere to its constitutional oaths and have public hearings, we would have prevented the Iraq War.
Ralph Nader, one last question. We've literally got 30 seconds left, so I'm going to ask you to be a little bit brief here, but I want to ask a big question. You know, you've been at this work in one form or another for a long time. You're 80 years old now. You defined effective consumer activism in this country. You've run for president 5 times. Here you are talking about a new and ultimately optimistic view of what can happen in this country. What keeps you optimistic?
Pessimism has no function. It's nothing more than an indulgence of a withdrawn mind from participating in democracy. The only thing that you can go forward is you think you can make things better the way left-right alliances are already doing and reforming juvenile justice in 15 states, already operational, enacting laws. And the other thing is this. I think with your famous Senator Daniel Webster, I agree. Justice is the great work of human beings on earth. And that's what we all have to spend some of our time furthering in all the ways that we know are the proper way to have a decent, responsive, and prosperous society.
Many thanks for joining us today. That's Ralph Nader. His latest book is Unstoppable, The Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. Ralph Nader, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mr. Brooks.
Well, that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.